You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 11th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, all. You know what happened in 1572 on this date, November 11th?
No idea.
Aha.
52?
1572.
Oh, 1572. Yeah,
yes.
I know what happened.
Oh, which was burned.
Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe began his meticulous observations of the supernova discovered in the constellation Cassiopeia.
Tycho Brahe is one of my favorite
scientists ever. He would have been perfect if he just had a bigger bladder.
Dude had a gold nose, an elk, and a midget. I mean, a little person.
And he was Danish.
Oh, my God, this guy sounds badass.
He really is.
He was also a mentor to Kepler, I believe, right?
Well, he gave his data to Kepler, which enabled Kepler to eventually come up with his three laws of planetary motion.
But do you know why this supernova discovery was important?
Because it was super?
It was super. It was bright for about 2 weeks, and another 2 weeks it faded out by month's end. And that sparked the notion in astronomy that the heavens were not immutable.
That's right.
As it had been believed. It opened the door to that notion that, hey, things change. Things are moving. Things are different.
What, comets didn't clue them into that?
Well, I guess the supernova.
Comets were evil, you know.
Harbingers of doom.
Big time.
So, Rebecca, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks. Good to be back. How have you guys been?
The same. A little older. A little wiser.
It's been a little boring without you, I have to admit.
Yeah, well, you know, last week I was so bored that I fell asleep before the podcast even started, and then I slept right through it, so.
Yeah. We're still working out the timing thing, you know. It's midnight there in the UK while we're recording.
Which is better. It's better than... last time I was on a full show, it was 2 a.m., and it was pretty bad. So, yeah, I'm a little better.
You were zombified.
I've been chugging Coke all night.
Now, Rebecca, if you have to go to the bathroom, don't be embarrassed. Go ahead and get up and go.
Yeah.
Don't feel like you have to stay on the show.
Right.
Blow your gold nose
while you're there.
Rebecca, how do you like the UK?
I love it. I've been having a blast. I've only, you know, been here a few weeks now, but so far it's fantastic.
Do you have a bunch of new droogies out in London?
Did you say droogies? What's a droogie?
Yeah, come on.
Oh, come on.
Oh,
Steve, tell us.
We met him.
Don't embarrass yourself in front of 65,000 people.
You remember Roddy McDowell?
How can I forget?
Jay.
I mean, Malcolm McDowell. He was in a movie called A Clockwork Orange.
No, it's been a long time since I've seen that. But everybody, we went to a Halloween party, and everybody thought I was dressed up like a guy from A Clockwork Orange. Because I was wearing a bowler hat and a black suit, and I had a monocle and a cigarette holder, and a mustache. And I kept having people would say, "Oh, you know, who are you dressed up as then?" And I would go, "I'm British," which I thought was hilarious, but not very many people really got.
I love it.
Oh,
that is great.
I
love it.
That's awesome.
They'd say, uh-huh.
We're the only ones who
so
think it's
what
funny,
are you
right?
dressed up as? And I'd say, I'm British. Exactly. Can I clean your chimneys, governor? And yeah, then they'd smile and back away and never talk to me again.
Well, let's get on with some news items. Did you guys hear about the psychic who found a skeleton in the basement of the haunted building?
I did once you sent me the article.
This wasn't just a building, Steve. It was a 76,000-square-foot mansion. How big is that?
It's about 76,000 square.
That's pretty damn big, Bob.
That's huge.
For our listeners in England, that's what? It's a meter is a feet. And
I'm still learning my metric conversions.
The paranormal investigation group was bouncing around this 100-year-old mansion. And now the story is that they tell is that you know, they were drawn to the basement and they were hearing voices, and some of the psychics were like feeling sick when they were down there, and it led them to the remains, the skeletal remains of some person that was sort of hidden or buried in the wall of the basement.
Yeah. It wasn't the radon from the stones and the foundation right. of the basement or anything.
Do they have radon? Yeah. They have radon in the UK? I don't know. So it sounds like a big coup, you know, for those psychics. But if you read the article, buried in there is the clue to what really happened.
Well, let me see if I got it then, Steve. One thing that jumped out at me is it said that Lawrence said that they found a bone on the floor. So he picked it up thinking it was an animal bone. Wait a second. You found a bone on the floor? I mean, how did that happen? And then because it makes you kind of think that they dug it up.
Yeah.
But no, the bone was on the floor. I mean, if you're going to kill somebody, whatever, however many years ago, what, you're going to leave a bone on the floor that nobody found for years?
Pay attention to Bob. He knows about bones in basements.
Yeah,
Bob
right?
is our bones in basements expert.
You got it. Sheriff Richard Ferguson said that they cannot confirm or deny that it was even human. So, well, first let's see if it's an animal or not. And then, you know, isn't that kind of important to rule out that it was an animal first?
Yeah, but you're right, Bob. Finding the bone on the floor was the piece that stuck out with me. So, in other words, they weren't saying, I'm in contact with the spirit of someone who says that they were murdered here and hidden in the wall, and then the spirit led them to his body, right? That's sort of the TV story that they want you to believe. They found a bone.
That's it.
They just happened upon the bone, and then they're retrofitting. they're retrofitting the story from that.
They call it skeletal remains. Well, if you found a tooth, it'd be a skeletal remain, too.
even if we buy the fact that you know, 100 years ago, somebody was murdered and they were buried in the wall. Let's buy that. Who cares? They stumbled upon the bone that was falling out and on the floor of the basement. If you rummage around enough basements in old mansions, you're going to find some interesting stuff that people hadn't found before, and then you retrofit some psychic made up mumbo jumbo to make it sound like it was part of what, you know, of the investigation or what the spirits were telling you.
It's called retrofitting.
Yeah. So yeah, it's all retrofitting. Absolutely.
You know, this is part of the BS. Of what their story says, one of the quotes was, a couple of the psychics that were part of that group got physically sick when they went down there and they couldn't figure out why.
Sure. Right,
that's a good example of the retrofit that Steve's talking about, because quite obviously
they feel stuff when they go in these alleged haunted mansions.
Of course. Yeah, they have no industry if they didn't.
They know corpses right. are around when they throw up when they walk into a building.
Right.
I have to say, did you guys see South Park where they covered the ghost hunters?
No. Unfortunately,
do you see
no.
that? Oh, it was this season. Oh. It was hilarious because the guys are just going, "Oh, what's that? What was that? Did you hear that?"
I gotta see that episode.
And then they basically just piss themselves.
Well, that actually sounds like a word for word recreation of a ghost hunters show. It's always like the only evidence they have is, "Did you feel that? No, I didn't feel that. I'm sitting at home watching your stupid ass on TV."
Yeah, is their own reactions to non-existent stuff.
I feel strongly when I'm in the basement or in the attic. Yeah, okay. You know who doesn't get a little scared of basements and attics? You know,
where
who
could
doesn't?
That possibly who's come me? From?
You know,
I don't.
Fuck. Okay, Bob. You.
Bob has corpses in his basement, and he doesn't get creeped out when he's down there.
So we found an entire rack of skulls.
That's for the courts to decide.
But guys, they also did some EVPs, and they heard clicking.
Yes.
Oh, that's right.
Yes. That nails it. That totally nails it for me. I mean, what else? Talk about icing on the cake.
What are the odds of hearing something that sounds like a clicking noise in the background? So their explanation for this was that this place used to be a school, right, that was run by nuns. And, of course, you know, nuns used to, I guess, click things to tell their
Urdu
kids to
or
shut
something?
Up if they were getting too noisy.
Or are they doing a hat dance with canastas or something?
So apparently you can take the clickers with you in the afterlife. Is that it?
Oh my God.
Of all the noises to psychically make it through the years, it would be a clicking noise, right? It wouldn't be a human voice.
That was an EVP right there. Click, click. There's another.
How did they even come up with that? How do they even retrofit that? Let's see. What clicked back then? Let's see. What made white noise back then?
That's true.
The power of belief.
Maybe they were trying to change the channel on the TV.
Yes, we in America call the remote control for the television.
Unfortunately,
the clicker.
They don't have batteries in the afterlife. So they're forever destined to click, click, click.
And clicking!
And clicking! Clicking.
Jay, I was thinking the same thing.
Get a room.
Next story, some quick follow-up on the Desiree Jennings case that we talked about last week. If you recall, Desiree Jennings, a 25-year-old cheerleader wannabe who shortly after taking the seasonal flu vaccine came down with some neurological disorder or movement disorder and is being promoted by the anti-vaccination crowd as a vaccine injury. I mean, they were very quick to jump on this case and exploit this poor girl. And myself and other neurologists, even some movement disorder specialists, look at the video, and it's pretty obvious that what she has is not dystonia. I even predicted on my blog that because this seems to be more of a psychological reaction than neurological damage, that's the kind of a disorder that can get better 100% spontaneously. In fact, sometimes even just suggesting that it's going to get better is enough for it to get better. So I predicted that now that the anti-vaccine loons have their claws in this girl, that they're going to give her some quack treatment for presumed vaccine injury, and she'll get better. She'll get better quickly, and they'll claim victory. Well, that's exactly what's happened.
Steve, I like the title of your blog on this story. Well, that didn't take long.
Yeah, I didn't think it was going to be that quick. I mean, I thought eventually this would happen, but within a week. Now Generation Rescue, the anti-vaccine group, tells the story that they hooked her up with their expert, their quote-unquote expert,
who injects pee into people.
What?
For a fee?
Butter.
Does he inject pee for a fee?
Dr. Butter.
Rashid Buttar. This guy has been charged with unprofessional conduct in the past. He promotes a lot of really dubious treatments for not only vaccine injury,
dubious
but for other
kind.
Things as well. It is. So he gave her chelation therapy.
Ooh. Whoa.
And within 15 minutes, she was getting better. And within a day or 36 hours, she was
Explain
completely
that with your
cured.
Yeah, doctor.
So interestingly, that the speed of her recovery actually confirms that her disorder was psychogenic. You know what I mean?
Right.
They're, of course, claiming that confirms that it was mercury toxicity. But there's just no way that if it were, it can't be mercury toxicity, right? I mean, the amount that, even if we assume that she got the type of flu vaccine that has 25 micrograms of mercury in it, that's the most she could have gotten of thimerosal. That is not a toxic dose. That's the bottom line. But even if in a hypothetical case of someone with brain injury from mercury toxicity, it's not going to get better within minutes of being chelated to remove the mercury. Even if you could magically remove all of the mercury from somebody's body instantly, their symptoms are not going to go away right away. The damage would take much more time to heal or to get better. It would just stop it from progressing further. It wouldn't reverse it. So that is sort of the cherry on the top of that story. That really confirms that this was a case of a psychogenic reaction and not biological brain injury, as the anti-vaccinationists are claiming. Now, for a while, the Generation Rescue sort of vacillated on where they were going to go with this case, but clearly they decided that they were going to go on the offensive. Just today, J.B. Handley at Age of Autism wrote a really vicious blog post. This guy is a complete jackass. And, his M.O. is to just go on the smear campaign against any scientist who's trying to do any kind of damage control with the nonsense and propaganda they're spreading. So he attacked David Gorski and me on his blog today. And basically also all the any physician who dares to offer an opinion on this case, they're doing the predictable thing, trying to say that it's like irresponsible to comment on this case. But that's just ridiculous. First of all, Desiree Jennings put her story in the public domain. Right, absolutely. She put it out there, and she is going on a campaign to warn about the dangers of vaccines based upon her story, and she's putting it in the hands of the anti-vaccinationist. It's absolutely fair game for that reason. Second, no one's making a medical diagnosis or recommending a treatment for her. All anyone has ever done, not only myself, but every other neurologist who commented on the case was absolutely careful to say, well, we haven't examined her. This is not a medical diagnosis. We're just commenting on the video that's in the public domain. And based upon that video, this is my impression, right? Totally fair game. They're also trying to say like we couldn't come up with a reasonable opinion based upon the video, which, technically, again, I wouldn't treat somebody remotely, but movement disorders in particular are diagnosed by how people move. It's a video diagnosis. It really is a very visual diagnosis. You can absolutely teach, you know, residents, you can teach doctors what movement disorders look like by showing them a video of patients with the movement disorder. So this is one of those situations in which, you know, seeing a video actually is a pretty good way to make a diagnosis. Second of all, they're trying to make it sound like we're going against the diagnosis of her treating physicians. And that is not in the public record. Her physicians have not come out and said what they think her diagnosis is. All we have is hearsay. Well, that's probably just because of confidentiality, and I don't blame them for not wanting to get involved with this case.
Right, but she could have said it's okay for you guys to comment on this. If you really want to support your case, I mean, that's what I would say. You guys can talk about it.
Absolutely. She either needs to put her own medical records in the public domain, not necessarily, which wouldn't even really require allowing her doctors to speak publicly about it.
Just take
your records and put them in the public domain, or stop whining about other physicians doing the best we can with the information that is in the public domain. She really can't have it both ways. But here's the thing. A reporter dug up the fact that the probable vaccine report, you know, vaccine serious reaction report that Desiree Jennings submitted includes excerpts from her medical records, which contains the line that the treating neurologist thought that her case was psychogenic.
Whoa.
There you go. Wow. Totally
so,
Danny.
Now, we don't have it's almost certainly her report, but we don't have absolute confirmation of that. So, and we don't, but they're proceeding as if these neurologists at the hospitals that saw her at Hopkins and elsewhere confirmed that she has dystonia. We don't know that at all. In fact, the only evidence that we do have suggests that that's not their diagnosis. So they're playing totally, you know, footloose and fancy free with the facts. You know, Handley's propaganda blog today was just disgusting. It's as if he didn't even read my blog posts. He just attacked a bunch of straw men. That's directly contradicted by statements that I made in my writing. And he never links to it. Like, he didn't link actually, because he doesn't want the people reading his ridiculous nonsense to go to the primary source and figure out that what he's saying bears no relationship to what I actually wrote, you know?
Totally premeditated then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, he doesn't link. He completely mischaracterized what we said. He just went on a complete attack. And those are the points that he's making, which we already addressed. But he, you know, pretends like we're making some other case. Again, trying to say like we're saying that she faked it when we wrote we're not saying she's fake. Directly contradicting what we said. 100, you know, word for word, directly contradicting what we actually wrote. So he's completely intellectually dishonest. And for him, you know, he is. Like a creationist or a Holocaust denier, he's a dedicated ideologue, just like, you know, the bulk of the really hardcore anti-vaccinationists. Yep. And the facts just don't matter. You know, they just make them up as they go along to serve their ideological ends. That's the anti-vaccine movement. And actually, Rebecca, you sent me today that there was another report, this one on MSNBC, of a Virginia teenager who contracted Guillain-Barré syndrome. Yeah, within about an hour or so of getting the flu, or the, I guess it was the swine flu vaccine, the one that he got.
And he started having symptoms, and then something like a week later, he went in and was diagnosed. I guess it's a bit tough to tell for me, mostly because I'm not a doctor, but also it's just the one article. It was submitted to MSNBC by the boy's stepmother, and so it's only been you know, confirmed by MSNBC's health writer. But it's interesting because the article is actually pretty they actually do call out the fact that if this is the case that he did contract this disease, first of all, he's recovering. It'll take him a few weeks, some physical therapy, but he'll be fine. And also that this is actually lower than the expected rate of reaction, in that it's only one case out of several million, while they'd expect something like one in a million. So,
well, yeah. So actually, the article was pretty good. Yeah, you know, of course, out front they're saying, "Oh, a reaction to the vaccine," but they do go through the salient facts. And you're right; I mean, I do think this sounds like a case of Guillain-Barré syndrome. So his nerves are damaged, and he's weak and probably numb and tingly. And he's probably in the 80% of people who fully recover from Guillain-Barré syndrome. So that much seems pretty reasonable. And this is something we are paying close attention to. Every week I get an email from the Department of Health in Connecticut saying, this is a reminder that you're supposed to report every case of Guillain-Barré syndrome so that we can track and see if there's any bump with the rollout of the swine flu vaccine. It's something that's being tracked very, very closely.
Because it did happen with a previous flu vaccine, right, where there...
Well, because of the 1976 swine flu vaccine, where there was one case per 100,000 people injected.
Wow.
Normally there's a background, which is about the background rate of Guillain-Barré syndrome, but they said there was an excess of about one case per 100,000. But in the 30 years since then, there's been an estimate of maybe an excess of one case per million doses of flu vaccine, although it's not really confirmed. If you look at all the evidence, you can't even really confirm that there's a cause and effect there. That we can't really even say that the flu vaccine causes Guillain-Barré syndrome. But if it does, the upper limit of the estimate of the number would be one excess case per million doses given. So far, the reported cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome within 6 weeks following the swine flu vaccine are less than the one per million. So it's even less than the background rate of the disease. So there certainly is no spike, there's no bump in Guillain-Barré syndrome. You know, with millions of people getting it, some are going to come down with it within, you know, a short period of time after getting the vaccine. The interesting thing about this case is, you know, Guillain-Barré syndrome usually follows the trigger by weeks, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. He got it within hours. Mm. So that actually makes it seem less likely that it was due to the vaccine.
Oh, wow.
Usually, it's a secondary immune response that gets triggered by either an infection or some immune stimulator, which could plausibly be a vaccine. So, and then even if it were an immediate reaction, immune reaction, and even if we take worst case scenario, this was Guillain-Barré syndrome, it was actually triggered by an acute inflammatory reaction from the vaccine. It's still happening at less than the previous rates, less than the background rate. It's still extremely rare, and meanwhile, we're in for an especially bad flu season. You know, where an average flu season kills 30,000 to 36,000 people in the United States, 500,000 worldwide. You know, we may see 60,000 to 100,000 deaths this season, because it's basically two flus happening at once. We got the H1N1 and the seasonal flu. We're going to get a double whammy. And that's what the numbers are showing so far. The CDC numbers are showing that we're way up above average from the number of hospitalizations and deaths that we normally have with just the regular seasonal flu.
But not because H1 is so nasty, just that it's a double hit is really. It's two separate flus that's doing it.
It's a double hit, and the susceptible populations are different. It's younger people, pregnant women, and more healthy people, whereas the seasonal flu kills disproportionately, you know, the sick and the old, basically. Yeah, there's sort of different populations at risk.
So, Steve, this guy then, would you say, had a genetic predisposition to Guillain-Barré's, to have a reaction? Does that mean he's more susceptible in general to have that kind of reaction to the flu, or is it...
The short answer is no.
Okay.
That if you look at Guillain-Barré syndrome epidemiology, there does not appear to be any genetic predisposition. And coming down with it once does not make you more likely to get it again. It seems to be just bad luck. You've gotten exposed to the wrong bacteria or virus that has proteins on its coat that looks too much like the proteins on your nerves. Your immune system gets confused. It has a primary reaction against the virus or bacteria. It has a little bit of affinity for your nerves because the proteins look similar, and then it has a secondary immune reaction against
the
nerves, more focused against the nerves. It's just bad luck, no genetic predisposition. We can't even confirm that the vaccine's really causing cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, so it's harder to make other epidemiological statements about it, but probably not any genetic predisposition. Whereas other autoimmune diseases, there definitely is a genetic predisposition. There are what we call HLA types, which are, you know, genetic markers. And certain HLA types are at higher risk of getting chronic autoimmune diseases than others. That's why there's an increased risk if you have a first-degree relative who has any autoimmune disease. And it's just some inherent instability in the immune system, but not the case with Guillain-Barré syndrome. Well, let's go on to some astronomical news. Have you guys been tracking the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter images?
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. That last set of images that came out were pretty great. The most significant image that I saw was one that showed exactly where the lander touched down. And then you see little squiggly marks where the footprints come and go and where they set up the camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as the orbiter is getting lower in altitude, I guess it's taking more and more detailed photographs, and you could see you know, more detail and more lines of resolution and everything. So it's getting to the point now where the deniers really have to be running and hiding now, because I mean, basically we're seeing detail that they can't explain away unless they just say wholesale the whole thing is faked.
Well, that's what they're saying. Course. They're saying that, well, NASA could just have photoshopped these images.
Part of the grand conspiracy.
Yeah. They always have an out. Now where are the footprints? I'm looking at the image right now, and nothing looks blatantly like any footprints.
Well, Bob, it's not going to be footprints. It's going to be more of...
It's a black trail.
Right. Like, oh, so it's the black trail going off to, go off to the right then.
Yes. Yeah. Because as they're shuffling through the regolith...
That's it. It's the black lines then. All right.
Those black lines are the trails that the astronauts took. And it fits perfectly with
the
mission
awesome.
Chronicle
Holy
and also
crap.
With the images that were taken when they blasted back off into orbit and they took a picture of the landing site on their way up. It matches these now pictures from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So these are the Apollo landing sites. And as Jay said, now that we're getting closer and higher res images, you could not only see the landers that were left behind, but actually the four little circles that represent the foot pads. Of the lander. I mean, that's the detail that we're getting to now. And equipment that was left behind and the walking trails through. It's exactly
what we
would expect to find if we actually landed on the moon, right? interestingly, because I blogged about this today, I was looking for quite a while to try to find some moon hoaxers talking about these pictures.
Silent.
But I they're pretty quiet. I hope this is a testament to the way things are going. You know, looking through like the first 100 Google entries, almost all of them are skeptical, you know, and very few of them are for pro moon hoax conspiracy sites. I did find one that was taking the typical, well, these are just blurry images. Why don't they look like the Google Earth images where you could see the car on the side of the road? And the guy didn't realize that a lot of those Google Earth images are not satellite photos. They're actually taken by airplanes, which are flying much lower.
So basically, Steve, the moon hoaxers are unanimously sending back one big, oh, yeah.
Yeah, sort basically. And then also said that, you know, this could easily be photoshopped, right? So, again, once you're into the conspiracy mindset, no amount of evidence can dissuade you, because all evidence against your beliefs could be fabricated, and all evidence that should be there but isn't is being covered up.
If I were NASA and I was going to, as I had the gall to actually Photoshop this fake evidence, I mean, I'd, as cool as it is and as awesome as it is now, I would have made it even a little bit better if I was going to actually Photoshop it.
Aliens.
You know, I would have thrown, right. I don't know. Throw some garbage on the ground or something.
Yeah, you're right, Bob. You would figure that they wouldn't go through the rigmarole of coming up with like this satellite that's slowly getting closer to the surface of the moon, and you know, they would just say, here are some kick-ass images to disprove anybody that they,
I don't know. I don't agree with you guys on that. I think this, they would probably do something just like this, right? They wouldn't do the obvious thing. Here's a too-good-to-be-true photo out of nowhere. They would go through the trouble of calculating what kind of pictures they should be getting back, and that's what they would give us, and they would have it unfold over time. And those kind of details are exactly what you do with a hoax to give it that sense of realism. So I don't buy the line of argument that you guys are putting forward. But the bottom line is, this is what we said we should get back if we take pictures of the surface of the moon or the Apollo sites. We're getting those pictures back that we expect. That's what the moon hoaxer said. Why hasn't anyone taken a picture of the Apollo landing site? Now that we did, they're just moving the goalpost and saying, oh, well, those could be faked. But of course, nothing They wouldn't buy any images that we got back. Further, you know, you can there are ways to analyze photos to see if they've been photoshopped. So until they can produce some kind of a statistical analysis of the pixels, you know, in the pictures to say yes, this is something that's been manipulated.
Yeah. No, they're working on it. Yeah.
Yeah, this is just typical denialism, right. Just dismissiveness.
Or they're so good at manipulation that nobody can detect it.
Well, yeah, that's the undetectable evidence. Okay.
So let me ask you guys, why do you think somebody would put a value on disbelieving something like this?
Well, they're privileged. They have the knowledge that's in front of everyone's face, but only they can see it. Only they are smart enough to realize that the king is not wearing any clothes. It's a big power trip.
Yeah, it's more interesting than whatever their lives would otherwise be, right? You could go home, you could sit down, you could watch American Idol. Or you could generate this conspiracy about a moon hoax and think that, you know, you've seen the man behind the curtain. And you're special.
The government is not fooling me.
Yeah, and plus it feeds into there's a common, you know, fundamental distrust of governments and any, you know, kind of like large corporation and things like that. So I think all that feeds into it as well.
Speaking of distrust of government, that actually leads into our next news item. But from a slightly different point of view, the House of Representatives in the United States just passed a massive healthcare reform bill. Now, we're not going to get into the politics of this. I just want to focus on one little amendment that was added into that. It was written by Orrin Hatch, who's a Republican from Utah, who has essentially been a consistent enemy of science-based medicine in the Senate. But this provision would require federal reimbursement for prayer services. It would essentially say that you cannot discriminate against faith-based medical services. Now, this provision did not name Christian Scientists by name, but that's everyone knows that's what it's really targeted for. Yeah. So, you know, Christian Scientists will, instead of modern medicine, because they don't believe in medicine, and the very quick backstory on that is they think that all of physical reality is an illusion, and therefore all of disease is an illusion, and the world is what we make it based upon our faith. So if you just have faith and pray, you can fix any physical problem. And in fact, doing something to physically treat your symptoms is an expression of lack of faith, right? So that's in a nutshell their belief system they're coming from. So, but here's the thing: they charge for their prayer services as if they were medical interventions. Mm-hmm. This provision would mean that insurance companies and the government and states would have to pay to reimburse for Christian Science prayer as if it were real medicine.
Steve, I'm telling you right now, if that gets passed, I am going to charge for prayer.
Well, that's the thing, Jay. What's stopping anyone from charging for anything that's faith-based? You could do anything. That basically, when you put in provisions like that say you can't, quote-unquote, discriminate, what that means is that you've now eliminated the scientific standard of care, right? There's now no standard of care. Anything can pass. If prayer can pass as medicine, anything can now pass as a medical intervention. This will explode out of control.
Wow.
And in case anybody is wondering if there's any sort of greater harm to this, because the thing is, it's usually not that much money. They charge, you know, $10, $20 a session usually. But
not anymore.
Quickly, yeah. Yeah, really, it's about to skyrocket. But just to quickly note that a few years ago, 2 years ago maybe, in Boston there was a measles outbreak specifically because of the Christian Scientists. They don't believe in vaccinations, obviously, and there's quite a population of them in Boston. They have it's their headquarters, thanks to that, measles outbreak.
You snuck in there one night or something.
They were having their world meeting at that time. Which is not really good timing on their part.
Right? No kidding.
We should note that the provision was actually introduced in the House, because Hatch is a senator, not a representative in the House, by Representative John Shimkus, whose district includes a Christian Science school. And supported by Senator John Kerry and Edward Kennedy, both senators from Massachusetts, which is the headquarters of the church.
Wow, John Kerry supports that.
Yeah.
Oh, well, man. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, Christian Science is
born in Boston, right?
Yep.
So now the bill has to well, the Senate's going to try to pass their version, and you know Orrin Hatch is going to try to introduce the provision there. Then they'll have to, you know, they'll details will be hammered out in committee. So this isn't set in stone yet. I mean, there's opportunity to draw public attention to this and to put pressure. So if you live in the United States, check out our, you know, writings on this issue on Neurologica and on science-based medicine, and we are preparing more documents on this issue. But even at this point in time, you can get the background information that you need. Write your representative, write your senator, complain about this bill. It's unconstitutional, and it's a terrible bill, a provision, and it certainly would be open season for any kind of quackery that you could imagine with this kind of quote-unquote non-discriminatory provision. So now is the time to get active and to try to nip this in the bud.
And if you don't live in the United States, feel free to laugh at us.
And if did you guys know that there's already laws on the books that that forces the IRS to allow for tax deductions for medical expenses for Christian Science Prayer?
No. Really?
No. Yep, you can deduct Christian Science Prayer as a medical deduction. And also some military health care plans are forced to cover Christian Science Prayer. So these kind of things have already slipped through. I've already you know, gone under the radar and slipped through and around the books. If we draw enough attention to this, maybe we can get rid of all three of those things. You know, it may backfire and draw attention to these things that have already happened. Let's go on to some questions and emails. The first one comes from Dan Kress from Rochester, New York. And Dan writes, "Great show, guys. Love it. I have finally caught up after 6 months, and I'm now very disappointed to have to wait for it once a week. I have been studying quantum physics for a bit now and was hoping that Bob could give his explanation of the uncertainty principle and wave-particle duality."
In 60 seconds.
Take it, Bob.
"My understanding so far is this. The amplitude of a wave defines a particle's position. The wavelength defines its momentum. We cannot know both of the things at the same time, only one or the other. This is not an artifact of the inaccuracies of our tools for measuring, but a fundamental property of some atomic particles. My first question is the drawing of a wave on paper just a two-dimensional representation of a more abstract idea of what a wave really is, or can we literally imagine a particle flying through space, oscillating up and down along its amplitude? My second question is how this relates to photon slit experiments. Does the photon display the properties of a wave as it is flying towards the slit, and then display the properties of a particle when it hits the wall? Is this why we cannot predict where the photon will land, because it is displaying the characteristics of a wave and therefore exists anywhere within the oscillating amplitude, even if all places at once? Am I trying to visualize something that cannot be visualized? If you please, I would like to hear Bob and the SGU's understanding of wave-particle duality, the uncertainty principle, and photon slit experiments."
And you have 30 seconds, Bob. Go.
All right.
Ooh, doggy.
First,
well, thanks, Dan.
First get an egg. Then, all right, Bob, you take it, Bob.
Thanks, Dan. I am no quantum physicist, but I do play one on a podcast, so I will give it a go. And also, we'll put some good links on our show notes for
to actual real information.
If you want more detail and authority that I can't offer here. For a first little background, I think, is needed. Wave-particle duality, what the hell is that? That refers to the dual nature of light. Some people consider this the central mystery of quantum mechanics. It's a fascinating topic. Light is not either a wave or a particle, but somehow some weird fusion of both at the same time. Some experiments show its wave nature, and other experiments show its particle nature. For example, diffraction and interference. If you're seeing that in your experiments, and that's definitely wave phenomena. If you're seeing, the photoelectric effect is one example of the particle nature of light. If you're seeing a photoelectric effect, it looks like particles is the best explanation for that. So it's kind of both at the same time. But most interestingly, though, that this dual nature doesn't just sit with the, you know, atoms and light. It extends to molecules and even to all macroscopic objects. So yes, you and I, we both have wavelengths, but they are so incredibly small that our wave properties aren't seen. I think that's one of the really interesting takeaways from that.
So I'm oscillating right now.
We have to give this. That's the de Broglie limit, right? That's that he calculates the effective wavelength of objects. For a person, it's actually a lot smaller than the size of an elementary particle. I mean,
right.
It's not just small, like on human scales small. It's small on subatomic particle scale small. It's
right.
It's insignificantly itsy-bitsy.
Yeah,
right.
Really yeah. small.
Interestingly, to give a little bit of the history, for a while, physicists debated about whether or not light was a wave right. or a particle. And then, as Bob mentioned, there were a number of experiments which showed that it clearly was a wave, right up until Einstein's paper on the photoelectric effect. That was actually the experiment that showed that it had to have a particle-like character as well.
And, right, he won the Nobel Prize for that.
Eventually. But also interestingly, Bob, at the same time, it was pretty much taken for granted that the electron was a particle. And
right.
then it was later that it was discovered that the electron also must have wave-like properties as well. So they kind of started at opposite ends where, okay, light's a wave, electrons are particles, and then eventually we discovered that they both are both. In fact, as you said, everything
right.
is both. Yeah.
Dan was asking about a 2D representation, right? Is that, you know, is that kind of really what it is? Or he's talking about how to imagine this, and that's always a problem with quantum mechanics. Imagining any of it is pretty much impossible. But there are things you can do to visualize it in your head. I don't think we can internalize this dual nature of light enough to visualize it as it truly is. I think this might be just a fundamental limitation of how humans perceive the world or just our intelligence, kind of like trying to teach a dog algebra. There's just no way really to fully wrap our heads around it. At least not until maybe the singularity. But depending on the context of this visualization, though, I think you can legitimately visualize it in a number of ways. Each one is the correct way to see it, I think, if it makes sense in the context. You can visualize it as a simple 2D wave, and that would be sufficient for many applications. If you want to visualize it in three dimensions, though, then try to imagine it as an oscillating magnetic field 90 degrees away from an oscillating electric field. Each field is creating the other, letting it fly through even the vacuum of space. No ether is required.
Yeah. Those are Maxwell's equations, right, that actually showed that.
Yeah.
Electromagnetic waves are actually electrical fields generating magnetic fields, generating electrical fields, and sort of self-propagating at the speed of light.
Exactly. Yeah, and when he solved for his equations, out popped the speed of light. It was like, oh, okay, very cool. And of course, the other obvious way you could visualize it is as a discrete photon or a packet of energy.
Now, Bob, in terms of whether or not the wave is a literal physical wave, my understanding has always been that the wave-like aspect of elementary particles like photons or electrons is a mathematical probability wave, a probability of where it would be at any point in time.
Right, yeah.
So
yeah, you could talk about the evolution of the Schrodinger equation and
yeah.
So the uncertainty principle. Okay, this one is really cool. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, also known as the indeterminacy principle. This is the notion that since matter ultimately has this spread out wave-like nature, that it's impossible to pin it down precisely. Once you get to the quantum scale, there is then this fundamental limit to the extent we can examine nature. For example, objects of study often consist of pairs of quantities like position and momentum. If you're doing an experiment with, say, subatomic particles, position and momentum are very important aspects of them. So Heisenberg said that we cannot know both these quantities with arbitrary precision. The more you know one, the less clear the other one becomes. If we know position with absolute precision, then there's nothing that we can know about its momentum. That's just the way nature is presenting itself to us. So this is very important to stress that this limitation is not due to our primitive technology, as Dan mentions above, or even our brain structure, but it's impossible in principle.
Yeah, it's a property of matter itself. At the quantum level, matter is smeared out. So you can't localize it with incredible precision because it isn't localized in that way. And the thing that really drove it home for me was when I read that, like with neutron stars, when they start to really collapse down under their own mass and the elementary particles get squeezed closer and closer together.
Right.
At some point, when all those elementary particles get squeezed down, they can't be moving, right? Because they're just too tightly packed.
Oh, the Pauli exclusion principle?
Yeah, you actually get to the point where there's an actual force that results from the fact that they can't be not moving, because then if they were not moving, you could know their
right.
momentum and their position to arbitrary
right.
precision. So the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is actually becomes a force of nature. And that force is called degeneracy pressure, and that pressure actually resists further collapse of the neutron star.
So on to Dan's second question, I'll try to be fast with this. He talks about how this all relates to the photon slit experiment, and then he has a few more details. But the photon slit experiment that he talks about is, I think, one of the most famous experiments of all time. He's referring to Young's double slit experiment from the early 1800s. Look this one up because this is a really fascinating stuff. This experiment clearly shows not only duality, in which light is somehow both particle and wave, but also complementarity, in which only one aspect can be revealed at the same time. So the setup kind of goes like this. Imagine a light shining on a barrier with two slits in it, allowing light to shine through onto a far wall. Light coming through the two slits then creates these two sources of light, which then interact with each other like water waves, creating an interference pattern on the far wall there with bright and dark spots. You know, kind of straightforward stuff there. The really, really weird stuff happens when you shine light so dim that only one photon is traversing the slits at a time. Even in this case, an interference pattern builds up somehow, which means, I mean, what other conclusion can you come to other than that it seems that the single photon of light is entering both slits at once and interfering with itself?
Right.
Which is pretty bizarre stuff. And this happens even with electrons, lots of different things that they shine through there. So this experiment is pretty much a poster boy for quantum mechanics. In fact, Richard Feynman famously said once that – he's a famous physicist. He said that all of quantum mechanics can be derived from the implications of this one experiment. I mean, there's so many layers to this experiment. It's such an interesting thing. When Young first saw the results, I mean, his jaw must have just hit the floor for a week. Really fascinating stuff. So Dan asks why essentially Dan is saying, why can't we predict where the photon will land? And he's saying that maybe it's the wave nature of light when it's traveling through the space, and then it's
because God plays dice with the universe.
Ultimately, you're right, Steve. Basically, we can't predict where the light's going to land because quantum events themselves are inherently unpredictable. They're all, for all intents and purposes, they're acausal events. The best thing we could do is assign probabilities and as to where they will go. And this is what Steve was saying. This is what Einstein was so upset about for the last few decades of his life, and prompted him to say God does not play dice, which basically removed him from cutting edge physics for the last part of his life there. And of course, in fact, God does play D&D every chance he gets.
And again, the thing to realize is that that's a very distilled version of of real quantum mechanics, which is essentially a mathematical description of these experiments, you know. Well, we have a quick interview with Bart Farkas from the James Randi Educational Foundation, followed by another installment from Rebecca's series of lectures from TAM London. So let's go to that now. We are being joined now by Bart Farkas from the James Randi Educational Foundation. Bart, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks.
Hey, Bart.
Hey, Bart.
And
hey.
Bart has been a great help to the SGU on the recent TAM events, lining up all of our interviews and everything. And we are having him on the show briefly this week to talk about some new fundraising initiatives from the JREF. So why don't you tell us about those, Bart?
The JREF is looking for more partners to help encourage and further critical thinking in grade school age children. Of course, we need people to do that, and unfortunately, we need money as well. Resources are important. It is, however, sort of a tough time for everybody to be giving money, so the JREF has come up with a few wrinkles to help raise money that some of them won't put any strain on the pocketbook for people at all. The first thing we're going to do is, in December, we're launching our first annual JREF, the Season for Reason fundraising campaign. We have a goal of to raise $25,000, and we're basically hoping that the membership and people who are, support the idea of skepticism and critical thinking can help out with that. And we'll have a web page with a thermometer and all that sort of stuff. But beyond that, that'll come in a few weeks. We'll make the formal announcement on that. Because times are tough, we wanted to find a way that people could contribute to the JREF without actually putting any money up themselves. So we've come up with the James Randi Educational Foundation Capital One Visa Card, which I'm happy to say will be available to everybody within probably the next 7 to 10 days.
How does somebody get one of these credit cards?
There'll be a link on our website and hopefully on SGU's website. It takes you straight to an application page where you can apply for the visa and choose which card you want. To begin with, there's going to be one card design. It's a great card. It's got a picture of Randy on it with the JREF logo. And, you know, it's your basic Visa card. But what's great about it is it doesn't cost you anything to get it. It's just a Visa card. And basically, every time you use that card, it benefits the JREF. Mm-hmm. So if you get a JREF Visa card and use it over a 4-year period, then everything you put on that card helps us. It doesn't cost you anything, but it helps us a great deal. So we're really excited about that. And what we're going to be doing is, because when you get a Visa card from Capital One that's for a nonprofit like us, they allow us to have multiple kinds of cards, multiple designs for the cards. And so we're going to start with one design, and we're going to have a contest for people to design their own JREF Visa card. Mm-hmm. What we'll do is we'll have a contest here in the next month, and Randy himself will choose the winning card, and then your card design will become the second choice JREF Visa card.
Wow, that's awesome.
Wow, that is cool.
It'll be open to anyone. The only thing is you have to please Randy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's the final judge.
He's the final judge, and I actually don't know what he wants to see, but it'll be very interesting. I know there's a lot of creative people out there. It'd be great to see what people can come up with.
Oh, yeah. Are you going to publicly show all the submissions?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought of that yet. What do you guys think? Should we?
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
I think that would be a good idea to have a web page. In fact, what we could do is put it out there, because we are allowed 3 designs ultimately, so we could maybe even have one design that Randy chooses and one that's voted on by the membership.
Yeah, the people's choice.
Maybe even by the time this show goes to air, the card will be available. We'll have to see. Hopefully next week.
Yeah, and we'll have the updated information on our forums and on our website, and also, of course, on the JREF site, so you can check out there as well.
The other thing we're going to be doing, we're starting a monthly auction. It's a monthly JREF auction. It'll run probably the first week of every month. It'll have cool stuff, sort of like the auctions that happen at TEM. Stuff from Adam Savage, George Crabb, Phil Plait, Randy, of course. We'll probably get something from Penn and Teller, you know, all of the friends of the JREF. And those things could be anything from, you know, have George Crabb perform do a performance in your living room to, you know, some exciting item that Adam Savage had on the Mythbusters. We're gonna be doing that every month. And we like to, I was talking with Steve about this, we'd like to include the SDU in this. So if the SGU has cool items they want to auction off, certainly they can. You guys can be involved and make some money for yourselves. You know, further down the road, we got a lot of stuff going on. We're putting together a team of people to work on iPhone applications, and we have a lot of exciting stuff coming up that I can't talk about yet, but you'll hear about down the road. So,
all right, thanks a lot, Bart. We'll keep everybody updated. We'll put those links up. All right, thanks for joining
us,
Bart.
Man.
Thanks, Bart.
Hi, Bart.
Take Bye. Care. And now on to another TAM London interview.
Hi there, what's your name?
I'm Simon Singh. I'm a science writer, and I'm here at TAM London.
And what brings you to TAM London?
I was talking about my libel case, chiropractic, libel reform in general as well, which is kind of the big issue that I'm interested in. How can we change English libel laws?
I think I've heard something about that, and speaking as a new transplant to your land, it terrifies me.
Yeah, well, as an American, you know, the land of free speech and so on, and we think we have free speech in this country, but the problem is journalists can't really write what they want to write, and what that means is that readers can't read what they really ought to read. So if we can, you know, we've really got the most notorious libel laws in the free world, so we need to change those so that we can actually have a press that covers the important issues in the forthright, fair, not malicious, but forthright and robust way things need to be reported.
Now, Simon, you were also the recipient of an award this weekend.
Yes, gosh, the James Randi first UK award for skepticism, which is fantastic. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. It's well deserved.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, I was absolutely speechless, a little bit emotional, which is very, very rare for me because Randy's long been a hero of mine. And when I got into this libel trouble, Phil Plait and Randy emailed me and just said, look, we've got your back. And that kind of support has been incredibly important. So to be recognised in this way was very humbling. And I was also able to announce at the same time as receiving that award, I was able to say that I'm going to be a father next year, which is equally wonderful news.
So it's the first time.
First time. that I'll admit to. No, it's the first time, and it's going to be a wonderful. And as I pointed out. It's going to be born next spring, which means it's going to be a Taurian child, but I don't think people around here buy into that in a big way.
I know. I think Tauruses tend to be sceptical. So.
Oh, well, that's good.
Simon, thanks very much for speaking to us.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Simon.
Thanks a lot.
Hello, and what's your name?
My name's John Ronson.
John! I'm so happy to meet you. I love all your books. Can I have your autograph?
Yes, you can.
Thank you.
Child, I don't know.
I'm sorry, we're in the middle of an interview here. You're going to have to just wait. No, that's security.
Someone take him away and have him killed and eaten. No one says that.
Let me stay with him.
I am way too important for that.
So what are you doing?
Random child, get out of here.
So what are you doing at TAM this weekend?
I'm giving a talk about the Minister at Goats, about the movie of the Minister at Goats, which is the movie of my book, which is coming out in a few weeks' time, starring George Clooney, Ewan McGregor, Kevin Spacey and Jeff Bridges.
And I presume you've seen the film already?
I have. I've seen it three times.
And which one's playing you again?
Ewan McGregor.
Which Ewan always, McGregor's playing you.
Yeah, which always initiates a kind of what I can only describe as an incredulous cackle. The truth is actually he is a bit hunched and nebbishy in the movie. He makes a kind of vague, handsome effort to sort of slightly channel the very sort of shallowest, sort of thinnest veneer of me, which is basically remaining like incredibly sort of handsome and suave, but with a slightly hunched, you know, rounded shoulder and a little bit of sort of like that.
The listeners couldn't see that move, but I think the sound you made summed it up. he's Hollywood nerd, like how they have the girls in the movies and all you have to do is take off their glasses and muss up their hair and they're so pretty.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you like that? Can I take off your glasses and muss up your hair? Oh my God. Oh, yes. Ewan McGregor.
But he does turn out to be really, really good. I was slightly worried that you know, because he's so sort of handsome and good looking and so on. I mean, the gag of Goats really is, you know, that tiny, nebbishy me amongst all these kind of giant, beefy military men. But, you know, Ewan McGregor actually really does sort of diminish himself, and he does look like a kind of weedy guy amid the giant, fabulous sort of Cloonies of the movie. So actually, that incongruity is still there.
All right, good.
Yep.
And what do you think so far of TAM London?
Oh, it's great. I saw Brian Clocks.
Clocks?
Yeah. And apparently,
you didn't say that to him, did
no,
you?
No, no, no. And, you know, he's so brilliant. They named the clock after him. He was quite amazing. I was on straight after him, so I was slightly worried that, you know, Mr. Unbelievably Clever comes along and then Mr. Stupid Clown follows him. Like the kind of Mr. Ha Ha schmuck, you know. But it turns out that people like funny as much as they like clever in the TAM world. So in fact, you know, I was adored as the Brad Cox of humorous journalism.
John, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, thank you, Neil, and thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, John. Hi there, what's your name?
Adam Savage.
And what brings you to TAM London?
Well, as one of the co-hosts of Discovery Channel's Mythbusters, I've been brought here to, I guess, represent the geek, skeptical television community from the U.S. into the U.K.
And I think you've done a very good job of it. You seemed, the audience certainly seemed interested.
The hall is beautiful. It's really nice, and everybody feels really nice and close. You feel the audience reaction, which makes any talk much better.
It seemed to me that it seemed that the energy level here at TAM London is the same as in Vegas, despite the fact that it's an American TV show. You guys are really popular over here.
It is funny about that, isn't it? We're in Mythbusters is aired in something like 130 countries now. We got off the plane in South Africa a couple of years ago and were accosted by a bunch of people going, "Oh, Mythbusters!"
You mentioned in the talk that the Mythbusters that goes out in the UK is shortened and narrated as if an English audience for some reason wouldn't understand. What do you think about that when that happens?
I have no idea. I have not seen the half-hour UK cut, and I know that I guess it also airs on a different network in its full American version. I find myself hoping that they're cutting our episodes like into chunks instead of just boiling an hour down into 28 minutes or something like that. And given that, maybe it's fine. It could be.
They cut out all that boring crap.
We get complaints sometimes where people like, I see comments where people are like, "Oh man, that show is so boring." They just like, they take an idea and drag it out. And I'm like, are you watching anything else on television? Because we do like five things per episode. You watch other shows and they'll take one thing and make a full hour out of it. We're like, we're giving value.
That show's so boring. They do science.
they hardly blew anything up.
Exactly. Yeah, we got one of those coming up. We just spent 2 weeks doing bacteriological testing all over the place.
For?
An episode called Relative Filth. How dirty really are the things you come into contact with every single day, including shaking hands with Mr. James Heineman, and how does that rate in terms of other things in your house, your toilet seat, your light switch, etc.?
How does Jamie compare to a toilet seat?
I can't say the actual results, but I will say that after shaking hands, Jamie cultured some very strange-looking bacteria.
Something never before seen by science?
Yeah, they look like little islands.
Another first.
Little coral reefs.
Adam, thanks very much.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fiction. Is everyone ready for this week?
The second one.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, here we go. Item number one, scientists studying the frozen remains of penguins find that existing genetic dating techniques may underestimate species age by 200 to 600%. Item number two, biologists have discovered a deep sea crab that lives entirely on wooden leaves. And item number three, Swiss pathologists have begun performing robotic autopsies using a fully automated mini robot inserted into cadavers.
Holy crap.
Yep.
Bob, go first.
Oh, yeah. The hardest one in months, and I'm going first. Well, I'm going to take my sweet time.
Haven't you learned yet the first one to utter a noise is the
one, kept your mouth shut.
You dummy.
I just lowered my volume.
Scientists, they found these frozen penguins, the remains of frozen penguins. They find that testing the species' age through genetic dating could be off by 2 to 600%. That's so weird. The frozen remains of recently dead penguins or like mummified penguins from eons ago or what? What are you talking about?
Frozen penguins.
That's all you're going to say.
Yeah, from long enough ago that, you know, they could...
Like what you find in a bag in the frozen food section.
Penguins, of course.
So species age. And a species generally, the average length, the average amount of time that species persist is what? 2 million years? Oh, man. Geez, I don't know. Let's see. Let's look at the next one. The deep sea crab that lives entirely on wood and leaves. So it's a deep sea crab. So where the hell is it getting the wood and leaves then? If it's in the deep sea. And there's no nutrition in wood and leaves. How could they subsist on that alone? And why the hell would it have evolved into the deep sea?
Plenty of fiber.
Wow. So I don't like that one at all. It doesn't make much sense on many levels. Now we got these Swiss pathologists, robotic autopsies using fully automated mini robot. How the hell are they going to get around inside a corpse with no bloodstream? Everything's congealed and nasty. They're just going to be wading through the body. See, that reason alone might make me pick that one, but this crab one is killing me. wooden leaves.
Crab one's making the itch, Bob.
Robotic autopsy.
Bob's all pissed off. Wooden leaves.
I love when Bob gets angry at questions.
Fully automated. Okay, I guess that decides it. I'm going to say that the mini robot autopsy guys are false.
Okay, Rebecca.
I have no idea, and I'm really tired. So I'm going to go with the deep sea crab.
As the fiction.
That's fiction.
Okay. Jay?
Okay, so we have scientists studying the frozen remains of penguins find the existing genetic dating techniques may underestimate species' age by 200 to 600%. Wow. Well, okay, if they did genetic dating, then they very well could have, I guess, proven that their estimates were wrong. The next one, biologists have discovered a deep sea crab that lives entirely on wood and leaves. So, like, he eats the wood and then he leaves and he goes where?
That's funny.
To find more wood, I guess, right? So,
well done.
Deep sea meaning how deep, Steve?
You know, not the shore. Deep sea.
Okay.
Yeah.
Deep, like 20 feet, 100 feet, 1,000 feet?
No, that would be the shore. That would be the shelf, you know, deep sea.
Okay, so Bob asked a very cromulent question. Where's he getting the wood from?
Yes, Steve, where?
I guess that's what you're supposed to figure out.
Well, there are submerged forests underwater, but it's not like they evolved to deal with them.
Yeah, I mean, the only wood I can think of would be sunken ships or, you know, wood that floats from island to island that slips into the water or whatever, but is that enough? I don't know. All right, next one. Swiss pathologists have begun performing robotic autopsies using a fully automated mini robot inserted into cadavers. All right, so Steve, when you say like there's a mini robot they insert into a cadaver, it sounds like a little sketchy machine that's jigging along doing its own thing. I mean, that doesn't sound so... Is it like autonomous, meaning it's completely on its own, no direction?
Yes, Steve, is it?
It's fully automated.
I can't get anything out of him, Rebecca.
I'm shocked.
I don't know. What is this, like one of those electric can opener type jobs? Like, I don't think so. That sounds weird. I just can't see them dropping a robot on a corpse and just letting it go at it. A little robot. I don't know. I'm not getting it, apparently, but that one sounds fake to me.
Okay, Evan?
Well, I think I'll read all three in their entirety again and hem and haw for a while. Robots, mini robots, fiction.
Okay.
Take your time, man.
You all agree.
I took 10 minutes while you guys were all hashing it.
Scientists studying the frozen remains of penguins find that existing genetic dating techniques may underestimate species age by 200 to 600%. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the Antarctica is actually a treasure trove of sequential genetic information because you can just keep digging deeper in the ice and find older and older penguin bones that are frozen and therefore have preserved genetic material. So what they've been doing is examining the rate of genetic change, of mutations, occurring in this one analysis in the mitochondrial DNA in a species of penguin going back about 40,000 years.
Whoa.
And what they found is that the rate of change, of mutational change, is actually quite different than what we've been using as the standard clock, you know, for genetic analysis. So,
holy crap!
Yeah, so we use genetic analysis to say, like humans and chimps, we share a common ancestor.
Right.
How far back in time is that common ancestor? Well, let's look count up the number of mutational changes in specific genes between humans and chimps, and we have our molecular clock, how many mutations occur on average over time, and then we calculate how far back in time that common ancestor must be. And, you know, sometimes we get ages that seem to correspond well with fossil evidence, and other times we get ages that don't really coincide very well with the fossil evidence. What they're finding is that, you know, first of all, there's actually quite a bit of variability, that the molecular clock is different for different genes, and also that Looking at the mitochondrial DNA, which is, I guess, often used for this kind of molecular dating, the molecular rates they're coming up with, how fast the molecular clock is ticking, is very different than what has been used as the standard, to the point that we have been underestimating the age of species by 200 to 600%. So they, in other words, the branch point of when two species separated may actually be 2 to 6 times farther in the past than we've thought, based upon our existing molecular clocks. This isn't the first study to suggest that there may be some problems with the molecular clock that we've been using. Again, I don't think any one study is going to settle this. This is the kind of thing where we need multiple independent lines of evidence to really line up on something firm. But this definitely raises questions about the standards that are currently being used. And may eventually explain why there's often this disconnect between the molecular age and the fossil age of, you know, when things happened.
More evidence that scientists change their minds.
Well, sure. You know, this is always something that was somewhat tentative. I mean, we have a pretty good idea of the molecular clock, but we don't actually know. We have to infer it, and different lines of evidence show different things. This is one more line of evidence now that's pushing it in a different direction.
That's actually disappointing, because I really, for some reason, I just had, you know, decent level of confidence in the molecular clock. So now I don't know, you know, it's like crap.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to have to rethink a lot of stuff. Obviously not anything fundamental, like did evolution happen, just the sequencing of events. You know, obviously, you know, know the jerks at the Discovery Institute are going to spin it that way. But the bottom line is we're talking about when did species branch off from each other. And this is definitely going to have an impact upon that. I don't think it's going to change what evolved from what so much as just how far back in time.
Just the timing, that's all.
Yeah, the timing.
That's all.
Let's go on to number two. Biologists have discovered a deep sea crab that lives entirely on wood and leaves. Bob, Jay, and Evan, you guys all bought this one. Rebecca thinks this one is the fake. And
what does that
this
mean?
One is science.
Yeah. Whoa! The streak is broken!
Deep sea crab that eats trees. Very, very cool. And PhD student Caroline Hoyux, H-O-Y-O-U-X,
Caroline,
said, at first sight, it seems improbable.
When Steve read that, he thought, I'll use this for science.
Yeah, absolutely. That a deep sea species would evolve to live on so-called terrestrial food. But she says, there, you know what? There's lots of trees get washed into the ocean and find their way, you know, down into the deeper parts of the ocean.
Yep.
And also there's the occasional sunken ship, Jay. I mean, you're actually right. That contributes wood down there as well, and these creatures live off of it. The species name is Munidopsis andamanica.
Eater woodis.
Yes. And someone also brought up the fact, I think, Bob, you were saying, wood's not a terribly good food, and you're right, but this crab has bacteria in its gut that breaks down the fiber, the dense fibers. And
the lovely bacteria.
To break it down and live off of it. So pretty cool. Interesting animalcule, which means that Swiss pathologists have begun performing robotic autopsies using a fully automated mini robot inserted into cadavers is fiction.
But it'll come, but not
based on a real story. I don't. Has anyone read it?
No, nothing like that.
Yep.
It is Swiss pathologists, and they are doing autopsies using a robot. But it's not an automated internal robot.
Yeah,
it's
right.
From the outside. And it's actually interesting. So what they're using is rather than in a traditional autopsy where you completely open up the thoracic and abdominal cavity and you remove everything. It's actually really – I did this for a summer actually.
Wow.
And it's interesting. You have to sort of cut – like the top of the trachea and then a few other locations, and then you literally grab the trachea and you lift all of the organs out of the body in sort of one unit.
Cool.
Is that cool? And you literally what remains behind is an empty shell. And then you slice up the organs to look at the tissue, look for stuff. The point is that you basically demolish the internal organs in the process. So if you want to go back and look at things later, all you have are the sliced up specimens, you know. So they're saying one of the advantages of this new system, which creates a digital three-dimensional model of the body, right? So it's a virtual autopsy, or a vertopsy, they're calling it. The beauty is that you now have a permanent record of the entire skin surface and all of the internal organs of the body. And you can go back 20, 30 years later if you need to, and there's the virtual autopsy. It's all there digitally preserved.
If your operating system can read the data.
Right. And then they use a robot to do tissue biopsies, just like little needle biopsies, because you still need to get tissue. Like, you need to make sure that, you know, if you want to measure drug levels and things like that, you still need to get tissue. And there they use the kind of robot you would use on an assembly line constructing cars, like an industrial robot, not the kind of surgical robot that has the precision and control for doing surgery. You know, because this is an autopsy, it's like, you know, you can't kill the person; they're already dead. So you can use a more off-the-shelf, sort of low-tech industrial robot. Works just fine. You know, pathologists are still cautious, still conservatives. You know, they're not ready to jump on this bandwagon just yet. It has to be validated. So essentially, I guess what that means is they need to do studies where they do this, the vertopsy first, see what the diagnosis is in terms of the cause of death and what it can find.
Then they
do a standard autopsy and compare and see what the sensitivity is, you know, of the vertopsy and picking up the different pathology, you know, that there is to find.
So I would think that at least initially then this would be used for just standard kind of no brain autopsies.
Well, you know, there are two different types of autopsies, basically, as it is. There's the routine autopsy, and then there's what's called a forensic autopsy. In a forensic autopsy, you go into much greater detail, and that's where you're looking for where there's a suspicious cause of death, where there may have been a murder or something like that. So that's a much higher level. Well, anyway, congratulations, guys. Rebecca, I guess, you know, you're a little rusty. You haven't been...
Screw you.
Haven't been doing this for a while. You're a little out of practice.
What's the British equivalent of screw you?
Bugger off.
Wanker.
Wanker.
Bollocks.
Bollocks.
Bollocks. Bollocks.
Evan, can you play last week's Who's That Noisy for us?
Sure, sure. Here's the impossible to figure out Who's That Noisy from last week.
His face is snarling.
Yeah.
And John Connolly is so worried or concerned. And after Air Force One got to Lovefield, you see John Connolly coming down. Air One was full of glee. And John Connolly has this faraway look.
So who was that noisy, Evan?
Well, that is the little-known woman named Madeline Duncan Brown. Does anyone recognize that name?
Madeline Duncan Brown. No.
This woman, apparently, claims to be... she had a tryst with Lyndon Baines Johnson, LBJ, many years ago while he was vice president and president. So she was his mistress, and she did an 80-minute interview back in 1982 in which she described events... from her perspective, leading up to the JFK assassination, and how it was most definitely a political conspiracy hatched by her former lover, LBJ, who had the most to gain by seeing the president shot that and killed that day. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, I found this at the website of one Mr. Alex Jones.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Mr. Jones.
Loose change man himself.
I'll point out also that the basic premise of her story, that she was LBJ's mistress, has never been verified, and there are some who, looking into the details of the story that she reports in her book, Texas in the Morning, don't find her story to be very credible, and there are many details that are inaccurate. Did anybody guess it?
No.
Yeah, that was a tough one.
That was tough. That was very tough. But, you know, some of these are easy, some are tough, some are in the middle.
It's no balloon boy.
Exactly.
So what do you got for us this week, Ev?
All right. This week, it's another voice, so people will hopefully be able to redeem themselves this week.
So her idea is not a fortuitous concurrence of atoms, but rather to show intelligent design in nature. Second aim is to rescue from degradation, the archaic truths which are the basis of all religions. And that's what the secret doctrine is about.
Interesting.
Okay. That is interesting.
Some crazy guy.
Oh, wait a minute, just because he's talking about atoms and intelligent design and...
Crazy guy number 127.
Well, we'll find out next week who that is. But in the meantime, give your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
Well, thank you, Evan.
Anytime.
Jay, what's your quote this week?
I have a quote that was sent in by a listener named John Drager, or Drager.
Probably Drager.
And it's a quote from a man named Brian Green. And Brian is an American theoretical physicist and one of the best-known string theorists. He has been a professor at Columbia University since 96.
Awesome guy.
Yeah, very cool, and I really, really like this quote a lot. I believe that through its rational evaluation of truth and indifference to personal belief, science transcends religious and political divisions, and so does bind us into a greater, more resilient whole. Brian Green!
Thank you, Jay.
Nice.
Wasn't he a linebacker for the Steelers in the 70s?
It's wonderful to have you back, Rebecca.
Oh, yes, Rebecca.
Thank you.
It is.
I wanted everybody to know that George Trapp is playing in Boston for Boston Skeptics in the Pub on Monday, November 23rd.
So anybody nearby, definitely make that if you can. It sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be super cool.
Yep.
I have an announcement or three.
Yes.
Okay, one. We are looking for anyone who has experience using Drupal. That is a CMS system that we're going to be using.
Oh, Jay, if you have to explain what it is, then the person is not the right person.
Yeah, right.
Never mind. Anyone that knows how to use Drupal,
we need an expert in Drupal to help us with the website.
You have a case of what now?
I would appreciate it if people sent me in more quotes. I really appreciate your submissions. I'm sorry I can't read them all, and I just try to pick the ones that are the best for that week. So. And the last thing I'd like to say is, you know, we're going to Australia in a year, and anybody out there that wants to see us, please make the donation to help us get there, because, you know, it's an amazingly expensive trip, and we're doing everything we can to generate money.
Yeah, we really don't want to take a boat.
Yeah,
right. We'd really like to fly.
Thank you guys for joining me again this week.
Thank you, Steve.
It's our pleasure.
Good to be all together again.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.